My name is Daniel Whitmore. I spent 29 years as a profiler for the FBI's Behavioral Science Unit, and what I uncovered before I left Quantico was never meant to be told. This isn't just about murder. It's about ritual, about killers who didn't know each other, but who followed the same chilling code, a code buried beneath financial crimes, sealed court files, and piano keys smeared with silence. They were doctors, teachers, accountants, all with one thing in common. They saw the justice system as a broken performance and decided to rewrite the final act. What you're about to hear are the recordings I was never allowed to release. The ledger of death I traced across 17 crime scenes, the archive they left behind, and the warning they left for me. This is the story they built and the one I've been forced to finish. Welcome to the secret lives of America's most notorious killers. Some true crime stories end in the courtroom. This one starts in the basement. If you think you've heard it all, you haven't. Hit follow on your favorite platform now, because the next story might just change the way you see everything. Don't miss a single twisted turn. Echoes of silence. Retirement doesn't come easy for men like me. They say when you leave the bureau, the first thing you lose is the rhythm. No more briefing folders, no redacted memos on your desk by 6 a.m., no quiet knock on your office door followed by some green agent asking about patterns. What they don't tell you is that the real loss isn't the rhythm, it's the permission to stare into evil and call it by its name. My name is Daniel Whitmore. I served as a behavioral profiler in the FBI's Behavioral Science Unit for 29 years. I didn't track carjackers or bust meth labs. I listened to the confessions nobody wanted on tape. I sat in prison chairs across from men who described murder like a recipe. I mapped what the Bureau calls nonconforming minds. The public calls them killers. I call them narrators because they always have a story. That's what this is, a final story, one I was never allowed to tell. Not in official reports, not in front of the press. Because this one was too carefully curated. The first time I saw him, I thought he was a victim. Clayton Miles, 46 years old, accountant, widower, known locally in Macon, Georgia as a mild-mannered piano teacher with impeccable grooming and even more impeccable spreadsheets. He'd been missing for 3 weeks. When we found him, it wasn't in his home. It was inside a metal storage unit off Route 26. The lock had been cut, but nothing was taken. The neighbors said they smelled wax. I still remember that first image like it's laminated to the inside of my skull. Clayton seated in a white folding chair, his posture straight, his face serene. Two women lay beside him, one on each side, eyes closed, not from rigor mortis, but from carefully applied white paint, their hands folded over their chests like sleeping brides. And in the corner of the unit, a Bluetooth speaker looping a classical piano piece in F minor. It took us hours to identify it, Bach's Prelude BWV 881. Cold, predictable, almost holy. He wasn't just a murderer. He was a composer of murder narratives. The local coroner ruled it a murder-suicide, but the details didn't sit right. His pulse had stopped before theirs. He'd ingested something, slow-acting, paralyzing. The women had bruises on their wrists, but no signs of struggle. There were no ropes, no fingerprints, only piano wire fragments beneath the tongue of the younger victim, a 19-year-old real estate intern. This wasn't rage. It was ritual. The entire crime scene felt unsettlingly symmetrical. That's the word that stuck with me. Symmetrical. Every inch of that storage unit felt like it was arranged for a photograph no one would ever see. And yet, someone had to. Someone wanted the staging. The symmetry. The silence. It took 6 months to trace the offshore accounts. Clayton had been moving money for clients, but not in ways we expected. These weren't rich CEOs or cartel bosses. These were pillars of small-town America. A Baptist preacher, a local school board member, a city zoning inspector. Each of them had recently vanished. No bodies. Just notes, suicide or travel-related. That's when I knew. Clayton wasn't the first in this pattern. He was the latest storyteller in a line of killers who saw murder not as chaos, but as curation. Here's what most people don't understand about the true crime genre. It's not about justice. It's about control. Killers who clean their crime scenes, who write monologues in blood, or compose exit music, they're not trying to evade capture. They're trying to direct the narrative. They want the story told just right. What Clayton left behind wasn't a trail of guilt. It was a performance. And when I started digging into his personal journals, his studio files, his case folders, I found phrases that echoed across other profiles I had never connected before. Storytelling secrets, unraveling stories, chilling accounts, nightly reflections. I began to suspect what no one else in the Bureau wanted to believe. These killers were following a script, a shared template, not just of action, but of thought. But that's the problem with bureaucracy. You bring forward a pattern, and they'll say you're reaching. You connect 3 murders, and you're praised. Connect 12, and suddenly you're paranoid. I called it the Shadows of Justice model. The Bureau renamed it File 191GR, and buried it behind so much red tape I could wallpaper my damn house with it. So I did what every stubborn profiler does when he's forced into a corner. I started my own case file. I labeled it The Secret Lives of America's Most Notorious Killers, and I opened it with Clayton's face, serene, posed, surrounded by corpses and candlelight. But even then I didn't know what I was stepping into. Not yet. Not until I read the footnote in Clayton's ledger, hidden in margin ink under financial codes and withdrawals. Perfection is achieved not when nothing more can be added, but when nothing more can be taken away. The others understand this. There it was. The others. That's when I knew this wasn't just about one killer. This was about an entire network of silence, not connected by phone calls or emails, but by shared psychological blueprints, a language of control. Killers who didn't act alone, but who believed the same thing, that the world's rot had to be framed like art. And I wasn't just profiling them anymore. I was inside their story now. Ledger of the Dead. The letter came 3 weeks after I buried Clayton Miles in my mind. No return address. No fingerprint. Just a single page, folded twice and sealed inside a plain white envelope. The page was torn, uneven, jagged at the bottom. The texture reminded me of the heavy journal stock used by certain academic press houses. It smelled faintly of mildew and something sweeter, old roses maybe, or formaldehyde. The handwriting was blocky, mechanical. It read, Entry 17, primary deduction settled, parity secured, ledger harmonized. The silence remains the conductor. The hands must remain clean. VL. And then, scribbled in the lower margin, just faint enough to miss if you weren't looking for it. Clayton understood this. The others will too. I read that line 3 times. I hadn't said his name aloud since the case closed. I hadn't told anyone I was still working it. Which meant this. This was either someone watching me, or someone inviting me in. Veronica Leonard had been off my radar for nearly a decade. She was a footnote in a 2009 case out of Charleston, a woman in her early 50s, charged with second-degree manslaughter in the death of her neighbor. The local story never made national news. The court sealed most of it. Mental health irregularities, they said. But the facts were buried in plain sight. Veronica had been a respected financial compliance auditor, one of the people who caught money laundering by tracking micro-inconsistencies across state-funded institutions, churches, museums, county clerk offices. Smart, obsessive, controlled. She was known for keeping everything in order, from hedge fund records to the layout of her hydrangea beds. The day of the murder, she invited her next-door neighbor, a 28-year-old single mother named Riley Garson, over for tea. Neighbors said it was a beautiful Sunday afternoon. Veronica had made lemon bars. 2 hours later, Riley was found sprawled across Veronica's kitchen table. Blunt force trauma, skull fracture, and her body had been meticulously rearranged, arms at 90-degree angles, a folded cloth napkin pressed between her palms, a dried rose pinned to her collar with surgical tape. In the background, classical music. Not Bach this time. Chopin, played from a cassette recorder positioned exactly 7 feet from the victim's head. And behind the pantry door, a single black ledger. Dated entries going back nearly 20 years. But instead of financial figures, the columns were filled with names, locations, crime scene coordinates, and notes like wealth shielding compromised. Justice tales require symmetry. Chilling details executed to specification. When I read that ledger, I didn't sleep for 3 days. Because Veronica, like Clayton, had created a ritual of documentation. But more than that, she spoke the same language. A language of balance. A language of performance. A ledger of the dead. I managed to pull her psychiatric interview from the sealed file. It was recorded on VHS. the grainy kind that makes everyone look like a shadow of themselves. The tape began with the standard questions. Name, age, address. Then came this. Do you understand why you're here, Ms. Leonard? She tilted her head. Smiled. Of course. I showed them the mirror. You're referring to the body of Ms. Garson? I'm referring, she said, to what she represented. She was the variable, the misplaced decimal. You don't correct an equation with rage. You correct it with precision. Then she leaned forward, close enough that her breath fogged the camera lens, and whispered. Clayton thought in notes. I think in numbers. But we all play in the same key. That line sealed it for me. These weren't copycats. They weren't inspired by headlines or podcasts or documentaries. They were part of an intellectual ecosystem. Predators born of corrupted institutions, shaped by professional precision, and empowered by the legal blind spots built into American systems. They weren't rage killers. They were curators of crime narratives. And what frightened me most wasn't the murders. It was how undetectable they had been. How each had hidden in plain sight under layers of financial crimes, red tape, and bureaucratic disinterest. I revisited Veronica's old neighborhood in Charleston. The house had been repainted, the garden ripped out, but the mailbox still had her initials carved faintly into the side, VL. When I knocked on the new owner's door, an older woman in a cardigan answered. I asked if anything strange had happened since they moved in. She paused, thought for a moment. Sometimes, she said, at night, I hear piano keys, just one or two notes, always around 3 a.m. We don't even own a piano. Later that night, I wrote two words in my private case file. Chilling narrative. That's what I was dealing with. Not a killer. Not a spree. A narrative. One told in silence, symmetry, and sound. One threaded through financial corruption and psychological erosion. One that stretched from Macon to Charleston, and I feared far beyond. When I got home, there was another letter waiting. This time, it wasn't a page. It was a photo, black and white, blurry, taken from a distance. It showed me, sitting at my desk, reviewing Veronica's file. On the back of the photo, in that same blocky handwriting, she was just the beginning. The Carver files are next. Be ready, Daniel. The Carver's estate. You don't forget the smell of old paper soaked in mildew and time, especially when that paper holds 17 death certificates, each placed in a plastic sleeve, each propped on a rusted music stand in the basement of an estate that shouldn't have existed. That's what I walked into at the Carver property, or as locals used to call it, the house the county forgot. The Carver's estate had been passed through so many shell companies and trust protections that it no longer had a clear owner. The deed had changed hands 34 times in 17 years, most recently via an offshore account tied to a defunct music conservatory in upstate New York. Every layer of ownership was designed to hide something. And the only reason it came to my attention was because of a mistake. A code enforcement officer, young, eager, had stumbled onto the property while surveying the land for rezoning. The front door was unlocked. The inside wasn't empty. When his report landed anonymously in my mailbox, no envelope, no signature, I drove down myself. No warrants, no backup, just a flashlight, a recorder, and a stomach full of dread. The Carver estate stood like a monument to absence, peeling paint, shattered windows boarded over with forgotten caution tape, but inside immaculate, every floorboard polished, every frame hung perfectly straight, no dust, no decay, no animals, just silence, and the grand piano in the front room, tuned. That was my first confirmation. This place wasn't abandoned. It was maintained by someone with a purpose. In the foyer, a single white rose sat in a crystal vase, a ribbon tied to its stem, a note under it. Sound is a crime of movement. Silence is the verdict. It didn't hit me until I reached the basement. There was no door, only a staircase behind a sliding mirror. Down below, a concrete chamber, cold and wide, like a private recital hall that had never heard applause. And at the far end, arranged in a semicircle like a silent orchestra, 17 metal music stands. Each held a clear plastic sleeve. Each sleeve contained one authentic death certificate, one printed obituary, some published, some never submitted, one single line of typed text, usually metaphoric. Here are a few that still haunt me. She couldn't balance the equation, so I did. The piano studio was too loud. Now it is still. The basement sings louder than God. Carver's silence feeds the ledger. One name caught my breath, Veronica Leonard. Another, Riley Garson. Clayton Miles wasn't listed, but his signature was a clipped box sheet tucked behind one certificate, printed in red ink. This wasn't a trophy room. It was a ritual archive, and it had a purpose, to unify, to connect. 17 murders staged by different hands, across decades, regions, tax brackets, but all collected here in one place. Someone had curated it, and someone had built it for me to find. I photographed everything, sent nothing to Quantico. I knew what the response would be, fabrication. The Bureau doesn't like art when it comes to death. It prefers motive, weapon, timeline. It does not like stagecraft. But I had to admit something to myself then. Something cold. Something terrifying. These weren't just killers. These were archivists. They weren't telling stories to escape guilt. They were building a library. And I had just entered it. On the north wall of the basement, etched faintly into the concrete, were these words. Storytelling secrets require sacrifice. Silence is the currency of justice. That's when I realized what I'd been investigating wasn't a network in the traditional sense. It was a philosophy, a psychological framework built not on contact or ideology, but on ritual precision. Each killer had found their own aesthetic: piano music, financial ledgers, death certificates, handwritten codes. But beneath the surface, they shared a belief in narrative curation, a fixation with balance, not chaos. A motive buried beneath bureaucratic camouflage. Red tape, sealed files, financial scams, missing persons classified as suicide or mental breakdowns. They hid not just behind crime scene investigation failures, but within them. Before I left the Carver estate, I saw something I hadn't noticed when I entered. Near the fireplace, the floorboards had been slightly shifted. Underneath, a surveillance monitor, still warm. The feed showed 17 separate locations. Not rooms. People. Some walking home. Some sitting in kitchens. Some asleep. One of them was me, 3 nights ago, standing outside my own house, drinking coffee. I reported nothing. I packed up my notes and left without closing the front door. That night, I burned all my digital files. I reverted to pen and paper. Because whoever built the Carver estate wasn't just watching. They were listening. I sat in the dark and asked myself the question every profiler fears. Am I still investigating this? Or am I now a part of the narrative itself? The unveiled pattern. The judge called himself retired, but I knew better. His name was Henry Arledge, 72, former circuit judge in Fairfax County. He presided over some of the state's highest profile financial crimes in the 90s. Offshore embezzlement, charity laundering, small town corruption dressed in courtroom polish. He disappeared quietly from the bench after a stroke, or so the papers said. But when I met him, there was no slur in his speech, no tremor in his hands. What he had instead was paranoia. And paper. Lots of it. We met in a parking garage under a shut-down courthouse. He wore a baseball cap pulled low, a blazer 2 sizes too big. His first words weren't hello. They were. They're not killers, Whitmore. They're correctors. I didn't respond. Just kept the recorder running in my pocket. He handed me a manila folder. Inside, 7 case summaries from 1993 to 2001, all involving financial crimes. Each defendant had walked free after mistrials or suppressed evidence, been connected to wealth shielding mechanisms or government contracts, died under mysterious but unrelated circumstances within 18 months of acquittal. In each case after the deaths, no inheritance was collected, no burial was made public, no family stepped forward. Instead, each had one unusual detail. A note was left, typed and signed, that read, parody corrected, ledger sealed. You know what I did, Whitmore? The judge asked me. I thought I was preserving the system. I used the red tape to protect the powerful, the ones who couldn't afford scandal. I played my part. Then he looked up at me. But someone else was watching. Someone decided justice didn't end with a gavel. It began where we failed it. I asked him if he had ever reported the pattern. He laughed. To who? You think a prosecutor wants to admit the crime scene followed them home? The folder also included something I hadn't expected. A map, drawn by hand. Overlays of all known locations from the cases. The Charleston murder. The Carver estate. A conservatory in upstate New York. A piano studio in Macon. A warehouse in Detroit. A hospital basement in Knoxville. It wasn't a straight line. It was a spiral. A growing shape that wound tighter with each new murder, curling inward toward a central region. Lexington, Kentucky, the geographic heart of the country's judicial training academies, a city saturated in bureaucracy, old money, music schools, and quiet cemeteries. That's when I knew. This wasn't just about financial crimes. This was about ideological design, a pattern of punishment for crimes the system couldn't or wouldn't prosecute. I spent the next 3 months on the road. No support, no backup, no bureau. Just one spiral, one philosophy, and the psychological algorithm I was slowly unspooling. One so well designed it could be replicated by killers without ever meeting. I began calling it the Narrative Echo Network. What made it work? Three things. Precision of ritual. Always music, always written record, always symbolic staging. Financial camouflage. Murders hidden beneath white-collar crimes, false identities, or real estate shell games. Isolation of guilt. Each killer acting alone, yet each operating by the same unwritten rules. I wasn't tracking a group. I was tracking a syndrome, a kind of murder justice, reborn through curated silence. Each killer shared traits. Analytical intelligence, professional distance, obsession with aesthetics, and a deep, simmering belief that the system itself was the killer, and they were the scalpel. They were the mirror held up to a courtroom that punished the poor and protected the powerful. This wasn't revenge. It was balance. Cold. Surgical. Ritualistic. By the time I reached Lexington, I had collected over 47 crime scene anomalies tied to this pattern. They spanned 30 years, 15 states, and over 70 victims. The FBI never connected them. Why? Because these cases were scrubbed from the database under mental health redirection, financial irregularity, or pending psychiatric evaluation. They'd been buried by investigation narratives. The Bureau's own term for cold cases too clean to be reopened without embarrassment. In Lexington, I checked into a motel and started cross-referencing names. And that's when I found the one that stopped me cold. Dr. Lenora DeMille, forensic musicologist, former consultant to the Department of Justice. She had written a paper titled The Criminal Symphony, The Role of Musical Structure in Ritualized Homicide. It had been buried in an internal journal. Unpublished. Uncited. The abstract included phrases I recognized immediately. Screams from the basement often mirror the tonal frequency of perfection. Chilling secrets embedded in arpeggios. Investigative storytelling through sheet music. Crime scene as curated silence. She hadn't just theorized this pattern. She'd documented it, long before I started chasing it. I tried to contact her. No answer. No voicemail. Her university file had been purged. Her address was sealed by a private trust fund. So I did the only thing I could. I drove to her last known address, a house on the outskirts of Lexington. A white picket fence. Wind chimes. No sign of life. But on the front porch, a package. Wrapped in newspaper. Addressed to DW. Inside, a cassette tape labeled Storytellers Unmasked. A single torn piano key. And a sticky note with one line. You've heard the music long enough. Now it's time to play. That night, my motel lights flickered. And across the street, a man in a dark coat stood motionless under a lamppost, watching my window. When I blinked, he was gone. Screams from the basement. I woke to the sound of my motel door unlocking. Not breaking. Not slamming. Unlocking. As if the intruder had a key. It was 3:09 a.m. I remember because the glowing red digits on the clock were the only light in the room. I didn't move. I'd learned long ago that panic gets you seen. I stayed flat, breathing slow, hand on the recorder I kept under my pillow. The door creaked open. Then closed. Soft footsteps. Then nothing. Silence so pure it hummed. After 6 full minutes, I counted, the mattress shifted. I wanted to scream. But I didn't. Because when I finally opened my eyes, I realized something worse than a person sitting on my bed. I was still alone. But on the ceiling, directly above me, a small mirror had been taped up. And scratched into the glass, in uneven, shaking gouges, were the words. We're composing your chapter now. I tore it down. Ran to the door. Outside, the parking lot was empty. No footsteps. No cars. Just the slow buzz of a broken streetlight flickering over the only vehicle visible, mine. But on my windshield, a single black ribbon, tied in a loop. And tucked beneath it, a photograph. Veronica Leonard. Only she wasn't in court this time. She was standing in what looked like a basement, arms crossed. Alive. Smiling. And in the background, a grand piano. Just like Clayton's. Only this time, The music stand held my face. That was the first time I considered leaving the case. Not out of fear, not out of fatigue, but because I finally understood what they were doing. They weren't just documenting murders. They were designing narratives that infected anyone who tried to investigate them. I wasn't profiling them anymore. I was becoming part of their structure. I drove 6 hours straight. Didn't stop until I hit a diner on the edge of Asheville. Sat in the back. Burned the photo. Flushed the ribbon. Drank 3 cups of black coffee and stared at the reflection in my spoon. I looked older than I ever had. Older than retirement. Older than every cold case I'd ever failed to solve. Then I made a decision. If I was inside their story, then I'd write the ending myself. I returned to Charleston, back to Veronica's old house. It had changed. The garden was gone. A young family now lived there, husband, wife, toddler with a stuffed animal that trailed in the dirt like an anchor. I didn't go to the front door. I went around the back. The basement windows were still sealed, but the external vent had been painted shut recently, sloppily, and from beneath the siding, something stuck out. A piece of paper, folded, wet from dew. I pried it out. On it typed, "You buried the story in silence. We composed it in screams. The basement was the real courtroom. And you, Daniel, were always on trial. There was no name, no blood, no threat, but there was a key taped to the bottom. I knew what it was. It was for the Carver estate. I didn't go immediately. I waited 4 days. Drove in circles. Booked rooms I never stayed in. Slept in parking lots with a gun tucked against my chest and piano music playing through my headphones to numb the fear. But eventually I returned. The Carver estate hadn't changed. Still symmetrical. Still spotless. Still humming with invisible breath. I used the key. This time, the basement lights were already on. The 17 music stands were gone. In their place, a wooden desk. My desk. The one from my office at Quantico. I don't know how they got it there. I hadn't seen it since my retirement. And on it, my FBI badge, my bureau file, every page, a cassette recorder, a mirror, and a single typed note. "Tell your story, or we will." I sat, pressed record, and began speaking. Not just about the killers, but about the bureau, the crimes we missed, the patterns we erased, the financial scams buried in policy language, the wealth shielding disguised as donation write-offs, the chilling accounts of domestic killings labeled as unstable family disputes, the true crime stories that were never solved because they weren't meant to be, because solving them would expose the entire framework of American justice as a shell game. I spoke for hours, and when I stopped, I left the tape there, walked out of the estate, got in my car, and didn't look back. But when I got home, something had changed. My front door wasn't locked. Inside, silence. And then I saw it, on my kitchen table. A single sheet of music. No notes. Just one line, printed across the top. Finale in D minor, composed by Daniel Whitmore. The storytellers now. The livestream countdown began at 6 p.m. No sender. No server location. Just an anonymous file labeled finalcomposition.wbm embedded in an email with no text. Only a subject line. "You're invited to witness the finale you authored." The timestamp was ticking down from 180 minutes. I watched it for the first 30 in silence, my reflection caught in the black sheen of the laptop screen. It was the same feeling I'd had the first time I entered a triple homicide scene. Not fear, but anticipation. The sense that something had already ended, and now I was here for the postscript. I called no one, packed nothing. I just watched. And at midnight, the stream flickered to life. What I saw was a courtroom. Not a virtual mock-up, a real, tangible room with polished benches, wood-paneled walls, and a large American flag drooping over a brass seal. It was my courtroom, the one where I used to testify. Fairfax County, 3rd Judicial. But it had changed. The witness box was empty. The judge's bench was unlit. And the gallery? Full. 17 figures sat in the pews, some masked, some barefaced. Men, women, aged and young. But all still. All watching. At the center of the room, where the defendant's table should have been, was a music stand. On it, a single mirror, tilted forward so that the camera showed only my own reflection. And beneath it, a cassette recorder. A line of text projected behind it on the wall in white serif font. "You told the stories. Now the stories will tell you." The feed cut out after 12 minutes. Just static. Just silence. I sat there, unmoving, long after the screen went dark. It wasn't until I stood up that I noticed something had been slid under my door during the stream. A USB drive, and a handwritten note in those familiar block letters. No more chapters, just echoes. The file is called Narrative Whitmore. Upload it, or we will. I opened the file the next morning. Inside, every recording I had ever made during my investigation, annotated, transcribed, formatted into a perfect true crime podcast script, complete with titles like Unveiled, Shadows of Justice, Chilling Secrets, The Carver Estate, Screams from the Basement, each matched to musical cues, each with time codes, and at the bottom, a closing line, "You've spent your life curating the killers. Now we've curated you." That night, I turned on the recorder one final time, and I said this, to anyone who hears this, this isn't a confession, it's a warning. We created the illusion that justice was a process, a system governed by evidence and law. But we were wrong. Justice is a narrative, a story curated by those with the power to end it. These aren't just killers. They're archivists, composers, engineers of silence. And I was the final chorus. Don't look for me. Don't investigate. Just listen. Because if you hear my voice, then I'm already gone. And the next storyteller is already writing in your shadow. I uploaded the file, titled it The Secret Lives of America's Most Notorious Killers, and then I disappeared.